And call this meeting to order. Welcome to the CVAG Public Safety Committee meeting. My name is Wayne McBurman, council member of the City of India, and I'll be chairing this meeting. Today's date is Monday, September 11th, and folks will be attending here in person, and we do have some on Zoom. So welcome as well, and if the public would like to attend, there's also options on the agenda to attend, and I'll ask Steph will call you.
Our land of Anaglia, Indiana. City of Life. City of Cathedral City.
Here.
City of Coachella.
Present.
City of Desert Hot Springs. City of Indian Wells.
Here.
City of India.
Present.
City of Quinta.
Here.
City of Palm Desert.
Present.
City of Palm Springs.
Here.
City of Grand Mirage.
Here.
County of Riverside. Torres Martinez, Desert Quinta, Indiana. Chair, we have a forum.
Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and continue with some words on today's date, this history. Today is September 11th, 2023, and we remember the tragic events of September 11th, 2001, a day that forever changed the course of history. Today, we honor, remember the lives of the people who perished, the first responders, the people working in the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the brave passengers on the planes, and those who lost their lives due to illness as a result of this incident. Additionally, we honor the soldiers who tragically perished in Kabul, Afghanistan on August 26, 2021, while working tirelessly to ensure the safety of others in true American spirit, including our own local hero, U.S. Marine, Hunter Lopez. Their dedication, courage, and honor will forever be etched in our hearts as we strive for a more peaceful and united world. We continue to pray for their families and those who are affected by these tragic moments. So if you can, please join me for a moment of silence. Okay, thank you. And if I may ask everyone to stand, and my chair, Reverend Gregory, lead us and pledge the flag.
Your hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the republic which stands for the nation.
Okay, we'll move on to the next item, which is item number four. And for the record, we have some folks who just joined us. That's one kind of bread. We have NUPD here. And we have lots of yes. We'll move on to item number four, which are public comments or items on the agenda. Do we have any public comments?
No, Chair.
Right. So now we'll move on to the next item, which is chair, committee members, and CVAC staff for comments. Do you have any committee members with comments? Yes.
Thank you, everyone. Part of the conversations that we've had, I was just sharing with my colleague, Mr. Dania, is in regards to the number of trees that we have fallen down. This, if I can place into your consideration, a collaboration with our environmental counterparts, that there are certain trees that are much more prone to falling than others. The Palo Verde is a natural tree, so we do encourage that with a lot of upcoming development projects. And the eucalyptus, while non-native, has one of the highest rates and they grow taller and more destructive. So if we can just have some discussion about limiting some of these trees, which could then be a preventive measure in regards to fallen trees and the public safety.
Appreciate that. But one of the things we're doing in India, we're encouraging our developers to utilize native trees and plants. And so that's actually going well. It's actually helping us in the water conservation thing. So it's also good. So we'll keep that in mind as we move forward.
Especially the new Palo Verde hybrid. match the one that tends to fall sort of rooms with less dirty. That's the one specifically that's on my list that I need for this. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Do we have any other comments that from our staff that are not Hurricane Hillary? Not yet. All right. So how about any of our other cities before the chair goes on his little soliloquy? All righty. So we'll continue. So since our last meeting in the city of Indio, we passed an ordinance prohibiting spectators and planning and coordinating illegal motor vehicle speed contests and exhibitions of speed and sideshows. And if you don't know what the sideshows are, if you look at some of your intersections, you can see some of the tire marks that are going on in some of our bigger metropolitan cities. This has become a big thing. It's a hazard, especially in the Bay Area. And so as it happens, things trickle down. And so we're starting to see some of that happen in our communities. And it's very dangerous. You see a lot of the accidents happen. They lose control of cars. Tires come off, pedestrians get hit, and so we have the ordinance, and we also understand that the California Vehicle Code, it actually oversees the speed contacts and exhibition shows. However, what this does, it makes it illegal to plan and be a spectator, and anyone who violates this chapter is guilty of a misdemeanor or is subject to a maximum of 6 months in jail or a fine of $1,000, and you know, this is something that we're not using it as a tool to find and arrest folks. This is something that we need to have in place for accountability. I think that's something that, you know, as a public safety committee and public safety as a whole and our state of society, we need accountability. You know, we need intervention as well, but we need accountability. And some of these speeding and sideshows are getting dangerous. So we took the initiative of passing the ordinance. And also on August 26th, we proclaim that day as Senator Lopez Day, and every year on that day or near a council meeting, that they will be honoring a service member each year. And this year we honor U.S. Army veteran Ralph Duarte for his exemplary service for our local veteran community. And that would include my report. And so now, now we'll move on to item number six, which is official updates. And just keep this in mind, we do have an item for the tropical storm. So we're asking you hold your comments for that portion. But if we have any officials who have updates from their city, we would love to hear from you. Don't everybody raise their hand at one time. Fire, we have a deep fire.
Good morning, Mike Beverly, Division Chief, West Desert, standing in for Chief Fish today. Just wanted to say thank you and show some appreciation to all of my partners, counterparts, all the cities involved. As you probably know, on August 6th, we had a tragic accident that took the lives of three of our staff members. And even with all of the hurricane, tropical storm damage that happened throughout the desert, the very next day we had a service to honor one of our line of duty death folks. So it took everybody in this room and a whole bunch more folks from all over the state to be able to help us get our folks out. Interstate 10 was completely shut down, as you all know, and CHP found a way for our equipment to be able to make it to the ceremony on time. And that was critical for our department to get healed up. So just wanted to say thank you to everybody that's here and a lot of folks that aren't here, but those individuals were honored and their families were very grateful for all the community support. So thank you.
We appreciate you. We appreciate your service, and we'll continue to keep your department and those families that were affected in prayer.
Thank you.
Any other ex officio updates? City of Indio, any updates for us?
We're just here.
Actually, no.
We're just hanging
around. We're kind of split the difference because we have a 9/11 ceremony going on at City Hall today where the chief and the other assistant chief is. And then Lieutenant Corp and I are representing the city here at CBAG. So.
I appreciate you. Thank you for being here. For the record, we have Councilmember Nunez Zoom from Desert Hot Springs. And seeing no further updates, we'll continue to move on to our consent calendar, and that's item 7A to approve May 8th minutes for the Public Safety Committee. Do I have a motion?
Yeah, I move approval, Kadeka City.
Second, Kadeka. We have a motion by Councilmember Gregory and a second by Councilmember Pena. Should I take a roll, please?
Paul Perez.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any nays? Abstentions? Okay. Oh, yes. I forgot our partners online. Desert Hot Springs, is that a aye?
That's an aye.
That item passes. So now we'll move on to item number 8. It's a discussion and action item. It's roundtable discussion on public safety response to Tropical Storm Hillary.
Sure, I can introduce this item, and thanks to so many of you for joining us, particularly our partners from Riverside County, from the Flood Control and Emergency Management Services. Kevin will go through a few images. For those of you who are on the front lines, this is much of what you experienced, and those of us home watching experienced from afar. You'll see through these images, Tropical Storm Hillary devastated our valley. There's been quite a bit of response from our partners, and CBAC's been participating, particularly along the major arterials such as Indian Canyon. Coming up here, you will see some before and afters. Our partners at the county did a nice flyover. We were able to get some pretty dramatic images that we will be using for grant applications moving forward. Some before and afters of the flood control channels. One more. And our sincere thanks to those of you who worked in the hours and days after this incident. We wanted to place an item on the agenda where we all could learn from what you learned and kind of the big takeaways. You continue on, Kevin. I know Cathedral City certainly got quite a bit of attention for the dramatic rescue off Day Palm. We just wanted to provide this opportunity really to foster a conversation. We'll start off with Bruce Barton, Jason Uli from the county, and then all of our ex officios want to join in. That would be appreciated.
Very good. Mr. Chair, is that me?
Yes, the room.
So usually who attends these meetings on Miami Dade is Michelle Paradise. We just walked in and thank you for driving out. It's representing the county. But today I thought it would be important for me to be here as well. Obviously, knowing the tragedies that have taken place over the course of these past couple of weeks. And I'll tell you, we have two individuals in Jason and Ruth that have done some great work. And obviously all our public safety folks that have done some great work over the course of years, but even more so we saw how they can work together and coordinate, make things happen, move things along and help our cities, help the county, especially after what we saw just the past week, last couple of weeks. And I thought it'd be important that we try to get a 101, if you will, on what happens on these type of tragedies, specifically from Bruce and specifically from Jason. I think that maybe there might be some misinformation out there, and I think it'd be great if obviously we hear from them what took place and the lesson learned, which was mentioned by Erica. But we might need to come back together again in the future to figure out how we can better coordinate, if you will, as a Coachella Valley. And not only Coachella Valley, but also we're thinking about Blythe and the 10. From Blythe all the way down to Desert Center, all the way down into the city of Coachella, all the way down here to India. With that said, I did want to just introduce Bruce, and I have some information here regarding his bio. And I'll tell you, Bruce is one of the hardest working county staff that I know. This guy is everywhere. And while we're having to deal with a tragedy year, for example, a natural disaster year in the Coachella Valley, There may be one at the same time in Black. There may be one at the same time in Western Riverside County. And some way, somehow, Bruce and his team and public safety overall, they make it happen. They show up and they get things done. And they get people into safety. And so I'm just impressed by the work of these individuals, and especially Bruce, who is also our director for the county of Riverside Emergency Management Department. Just so you know, I'm not exactly sure if you knew this, but he's been working for 3 decades. That's how much experience he had in emergency services. And he has a bachelor's of science and education. He is also the regional disaster medical and health coordinator for California Mutual Aid Region 4. He is also the past president of the Emergency Medical Services Administrators Association of California and was a gubernatorial appointee to the California Emergency Medical Services Commission from 2010 to 2013. And so with that being said, Bruce, I'm going to ask you to come up and give us a little bit of insight as to what took place these last couple of weeks, last week. And then Jason, if you don't mind as well, follow up after Bruce.
Get past the first two slides. Thank you very much, Supervisor, for that introduction. And thank you, Chair and members of the CBAC committee, for having us today. I have a presentation here, and I think you wanted something a little bit later on, an immigration surge as well, so we'll come back to that. But just very quickly, obviously all of you in public safety in this room know a lot of what I'm going to say. And, all of the preparedness that we did together as a team, all the calls, all of the coordination that happened with all of you, all the cooperation, that's really what makes it work. That's really how we end up making sure that we keep people out of harm's way when we have any kind of threat to our communities. And I think that worked pretty well through this particular storm. So just some things as we were hearing along with you from serial updates from the National Weather Service that we were going to get a catastrophic rainstorm. I couldn't believe it. You know, we say we have a lot of things that happen here in Riverside County. A few years ago, we said, yeah, but we haven't had a pandemic or a hurricane yet. And now we can't really say that anymore because we've had both of those things that have impacted us. So we were getting the serial updates. The amount of rain that we thought was going to be coming from National Weather Service was kind of hard to believe, but it ended up being as predicted, unfortunately. So before the storm, as we're having those coordination meetings, one of the things we decided is we were not going to leave anything on the field as far as being able to alert and prepare the public for what was coming. So we were monitoring and doing coordination calls with Weather Service. We were pre-positioning resources. We have, over the course of the last 7 years, acquired a lot of resources. We put in things like switchgear at all of our school district partners have worked with us on that. We put in switchgear so if the power goes out of the school, we can pull out very large generators. We have a number of 200 and 300 kVA generators that we pull out. We preposition those and work with the folks at Desert Mirage High School to pre-identify and pre-stage equipment there because we knew the vulnerability based on past storms that were out here, particularly in the eastern side of the Coachella Valley. So we wanted to be prepared to very quickly stand up a shelter out there at Desert Mirage High School. We did have, as most of you know, a microburst event that occurred on the Thursday night before the main storm came in that impacted the eastern Coachella Valley, took down several poles in IID service areas. We had power outages, we had flooding, and we ended up standing that shelter up at that point in time and just kept it up throughout the event. We do this is a standard operating procedure for us. We do a lot of outreach, particularly to those areas where we know that there are vulnerable homeless, unhoused folks, a lot in the river bottom areas, a lot out in the flood control areas. And so we had our public safety partners doing flyovers in their helicopters. Thank you to the Sheriff's Department and police departments that cooperated with us on that, as well as we had our homeless outreach folks out there contacting all those folks. They moved a lot of people out of the way that would have otherwise been in harm's way. And then once again, our folks on the fire service would have to be out there doing those rescues and putting themselves in harm's way for those. We didn't completely mitigate that issue. And I don't know how we would mitigate that 100%, but we did end up moving a lot of those people that would have been in harm's way out of the way. We did send out a number of wireless emergency alerts, and we do this. You may say, well, does that really work for the unhoused populations? Somehow they all seem to have cell phones. And because this was coming in, particularly following a bout of long, hot weather, anybody that wasn't paying attention that may be, you know, down in the whitewater area, you see people there sometimes that go to escape the heat. We just wanted to make sure that anybody and everybody was moved out of the area. So we ended up sending out wireless alerts to all those areas. And then we did something kind of unprecedented for us. We sent out countywide wireless alert. Once we were down to, you know, the day before the major rain was going to hit, and the National Weather Service was telling us with a great deal of confidence, yeah, you're in certain areas of the county, you're going to need 12 inches of rain. We decided to send out a countywide wireless alert to alert everybody to prepare. And then we followed that up with, here's where you can go for preparation tips. Locations for sandbags were at the county fire stations, and that was supported by our transportation department, as well as all the city partners. We do have a fairly robust burn area task force. So every time we have a fire, the people who were involved in fighting that fire, all the jurisdictions that may have communities at risk now for flooding after the fire, we call that our burn area task force. It keeps getting larger every time we have a large fire. But that is a separate group that sits and looks at, and we get the spot forecast from National Weather Service that particularly provides insight to our public safety partners, mostly in law and fire, who know those areas very well, and then can work with Jason Yuli, who is our director of our flood control and water conservation district. He kind of takes those, and we like to think that Jason has a crystal ball because he just has this way of being able to take those weather reports and say, here's really, you know, down to the street level detail, and then we have fire and we have law that looks at those and says, okay, here's where we need to evacuate. Here's where we need to get people out of the way. Because sometimes you can't stop what's coming. You just need to move people out of the way. But in addition to that, Jason and his team from flood, as well as county transportation and backed up by city public works in a lot of city areas, do any mitigation efforts that they can. They're cleaning out their debris basins, their storm drains, making sure that everything is going to flow the way that it can. Put a K-rail sometimes where it's necessary. And so all of that work was taking place and being coordinated through our County Emergency Operations Center. EOC was at management watch on Thursday and Friday and activated to level 2 on Saturday morning. So there was quite a bit of activity before there was actually a lot of rain on the ground. Go ahead to the next slide if you could. Our key messaging that we were putting out, I would say, if there's any one thing I'd like to, you know, take as a success out of this, is we had no loss of life, which, you know, I mean, that's the bottom line. We have a lot of damage. We're going to have a lot of recovery, but we did not have any loss of life. And I really give full credit to our communities in the way that they listened to the messaging. And our messaging focused on personal preparedness, to stay off the roads. We think they listened to that. We have the turnaround Don't Drown campaign. We were pumping that out. Everybody in public safety, everybody in public works, all our supervisorial districts were echoing that messaging. All of our city partners were on board with messaging that out. Sign up for Alert VIVCO, that's so they can get that emergency messaging, and then use official sources for updates and information. This is something that we really try to focus on because there is a lot of misinformation that goes on out there. We really want people to go to those trusted sources, especially if they are going to take actions for their personal preparedness or personal safety based upon the messages that they are hearing. You can go ahead to the next. During the storm, there were multiple patrols. Jason's folks were out there constantly monitoring the flood control infrastructure along with transportation. We had the fire department that was out there doing windshield surveys all of the time. We had the sheriff's department that was out as well. We had cooperator calls every day from the EOC telling everybody, here's what's going on, making sure that we're sharing that information. coordinating that one constant message out to the public, so the public would see us all as one public safety team with the same messaging that we were putting out. There were multiple swiftwater rescues that needed to be done, sheriff assisted evacuations and transport from affected areas. Some of our mobile home parks, I could go down the line, real estate, recognize every name that I rattled off. And some of them got hit really hard. A few of them had to be evacuated, and sheriff was assisting with four-wheel drive vehicles. We had also pre-positioned high-water vehicles with the National Guard at March Air Reserve Base, along with the FEMA team from FEMA Region 9 that were there to assist us and could have deployed had we asked them to do so. We did send out the high-water rescue vehicles, but the Sheriff's Department was able to affect those rescues without using those vehicles. We were also doing multiple, what we call MOA calls, that's medical and health operation area coordination. Apologize for the acronyms. But that basically the group within the Emergency Management Department, EMS agency that oversees all of the public health and medical system in the county. So all 17 acute care hospitals we were on with multiple times a day figuring out what's going on. Some of you probably heard we did have a flooding issue at Eisenhower Medical Center. Through the assistance with fire, we're able to get that mitigated, get some pumps over there and get that pumped out so we can get that ambulance entrance back open. Road closure info, it was really difficult to keep up. They were closing so quickly, so many of them because of the flooding and the mud flows. But there were not a lot of people on the roads. So that was a good thing. They were listening to that message. We did have a 911, as many of you know, particularly law and fire in the room. We had 911 communications impacted in the Coachella Valley. There was a primary line that was taken out, and all of the public safety agencies had to implement their workarounds of that. While the vendor, as well as we were having coordination calls for that particular topic in the EOC, we actually had Chad Ashcroft from the County Fire, who's our primary subject matter expert on communications in the county that was coordinating those calls out of the Emergency Operations Center along with state agencies to make sure that we were doing what we could to get that mitigated as quickly as we possibly could. And then we did proclaim a local emergency along with a number of you as cities that proclaimed local emergencies. After the storm, the patrols continued. We had a lot of outreach with fire, sheriff, emergency management, flood, transportation, our homeless solutions folks, DPSS, Office on Aging, were contacting their clients, their listed clients to see what the issues were there. Transportation was clearing the roads for emergency access, and that was what they were focusing on. There was a lot of talk about, we need roads cleared faster. When we had something like, a 1,000-year storm that came through, we're not going to be able to ever clear roads fast enough. We were focusing primarily on clearing them for public safety access, particularly emergency response access. We did have several areas that required standing water removal. We sent out staff. We had four or five contractors we had already put in the queue previous to the flood that were able to deploy and able to pump out some areas. Particularly, we had a couple of areas that were older folks, communities, and they had standing water. They couldn't get out. They couldn't get food. So we did end up doing some food deliveries as well. We did coordinate with Cal OES public safety agencies and all the vendors, as I said, to resolve the 911 communication damage. It was off 111 in an area that was a railroad easement, so there were some issues getting in there. But, they did get in there and get that resolved. Initial damage assessment was submitted on August 24th. We wanted to get that done very quickly. The initial damage assessment for the county was $128 million. We wanted to get that in as quickly as possible following the storm. So thank you to all of you who played a role in that. We wanted to get that in quickly so we could get the FEMA and Cal OES damage assessment teams on the ground. Basically our initial damage assessment says, here's what we think we have in the county. But then FEMA and Cal OES come in and they actually did site visits of all the areas that were impacted. And that will really determine, if we're going to be able to get that presidential declaration at the end of the day. We did do a local assistance center in partnership with Cathedral City. September 6th through 8th, we had about 250 residents that went through over the course of that 3 days, we had 18 state, federal, and local agencies there to be able to assist with residents. The number one concern there was insurance-related and, I believe, insurance copay-related. And then storm impacts, I think a lot of this has already been discussed. I really don't need to go through this. You folks lived it. I don't need to go through all the vivid details. Jason, thank you for some of your pictures I stole from you. And I didn't know, Jason, if you had anything that you wanted to say at this point in time.
Yeah, sure.
Related to impacts.
Yeah, now, Jason Healy, General Manager, Riverside County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. Many of you know we actually share our flood control mission with the Coachella Valley Water District. And so our district covers the very western edge of the desert from about half of Cathedral City west to Desert Hot Springs and up to the pass. And Cathedral City, Coachella Valley Water District covers the other half of Cathedral City all the way down to the east end of the valley. And so our two agencies were working together and coordinating on the storm. Before the storm, we're making sure our facilities were ready. We were making sure their construction projects were as ready as possible to accept water. There's some coverage on PS 41 along that lines. During the storms, we had teams out in the field, both monitoring and working. We had several crews that were stationed at various culverts, cleaning culverts, trying to make sure the water stayed in the channels and didn't get up in the communities wherever possible. And then as for the rainstorm itself, you know, this was unprecedented, really. We had 3 to 5 inches across the valley floor. Mountains, we saw 5 to 10 inches. And then up in Mission Creek, which is the canyon up into the San Bernardinos on the northwest end of Desert Hot Springs, they had 13 inches, 9 inches of rain in 6 hours. That's a 1,000-year storm. You know, that's something we wouldn't expect to see in our lifetimes normally. And that storm basically brought down a huge chunk of the national forest. You know, we were finding birch trees 24 inches in diameter, 20 feet long, all the way down to the railroad over there by Jean Autry. And so, I mean, this was just an unprecedented natural event. And what we generally saw is that for the first time in a long time, all of the major washes were flowing. You know, Chino Canyon Lake, Palm Canyon Wash, Whitewater River, Marshall Creek, all the way down to basically the Salton Sea, pretty much everything was moving. And everything was moving with a lot of water really fast. And in those major stream systems, they would pick up sediment and then carry that sediment into the water until they hit a constriction, like a road crossing or something like that. And then when they would hit that constriction, the water didn't have to carry the sediment anymore, so the sediment would drop out. And then the water would find its way over the constriction. Everything out here is sand, right? And so as soon as they got over that constriction, hey, here's a nice sandy wash. I'm hungry for sediment. And so we'd pick sediment back up, go on down to the next constriction, drop it out. And that process carried on all the way down to the Salton Sea. And if you look at aerial photos of the Salton Sea today, you can see there's a brand new delta that's formed off the Whitewater River of the Salton Sea that's about a mile wide due to all the sediment that made it all the way down to the sea. And so there were a lot of impacts during the storm. Our teams are out assessing our facilities, initiating repair work on our infrastructure. We had some damage to our Palm Canyon Wash levee. Our sediment debris basins were all collected sediment and debris. We had to remove about 30,000 yards of material from our Tocus debris basin in particular. We got to do a lot of touch-up work in a lot of our facilities, and that works on the go. I think if there's some good news that came out of this, it was a lot of the impacts, not all of them, but a lot of the impacts were to infrastructure in areas where we had expected flooding. The other thing I think we've learned from this is really that there's a lot of interim infrastructure in the desert, right? So all those low flow crossings, storms like this, they're going to eat them up. You know, all the interim infrastructure, it was challenged and overwhelmed. And so we have to continue to invest in infrastructure in the valley here, flood control infrastructure, road infrastructure, in order to be ready to address the next storm when it comes through. And so I'll stop there and be glad to answer any questions that you guys may have.
And I think that's a good segue to my last slide, which really talks about ongoing recovery. As Jason mentioned, it's a 1,000-year storm. Current damages have risen to $144 million now. Once FEMA and Cal OES come through and do their assessment, I think what they were trying to do, quite frankly, is they were trying to hang their hat on the presidential declaration for the state all within the damage that was done in RIVCO. So they saw us first. They came here first, but now they've gone to LA to San Diego because we probably didn't meet the threshold for the state just in RIVCO alone. So we haven't heard on the federal declaration yet. We're still hopeful that that's going to happen, and we will still be working with Cal OES. And I know that all of our elected delegation are concerned in looking at this. At that number, it would be the most costly disaster recorded in Riverside County history. Recovery is going to take time. In particular, the challenge is private property damage. That one slide that was just before this one that showed that area in Cathedral City, which was especially hard hit. Just mud just came through, and they all have like 3 feet of mud in their homes, a number of homes there. That's all private property, right? And unfortunately, all of the state and federal funding that comes following a disaster, not a lot of it helps private property owners. And so you're hearing that, we're hearing that. I know that there's currently a bill that's proposed that would basically look at FEMA does a thing called individual assistance. It's very hard to get, but once if you hit that threshold and FEMA provides individual assistance, then homeowners that are underinsured or not insured at all can potentially get federal funding. Other than that, the other thing that FEMA gives is they give public assistance, right? So that's all government infrastructure. That's not private property at all. So it's very difficult to get individual assistance. I couldn't hazard a guess as to whether we're going to get that on this particular incident or not, but the private property debris removal is always an issue. I think there's always an expectation from the public that government can do more to assist with private property debris removal, and we can't. There's not a lot we can do. There's not a lot of resources that we have available to be able to assist them with that. And I do know, once again, this came up at the LAC, at the Local Assistance Center, particularly related to underinsured and insurance co-pays. We will be, of course, seeking all available recovery funding, state and federal, and we will stay on that until I get the letter and the board chair gets the letter and I have their hand and says, no, we're not going to get it, we're going to stay on it. And then we will also be, we just completed local hazard mitigation planning for the County of Riverside. Our plan was just approved. We have 34 cities and local jurisdictions that are cooperating with us in that initiative. That's critically important for everybody to make sure they follow through and get those local hazard mitigation plans completed and approved by the state and FEMA, because that is what will open the door for you as local jurisdictions to be able to get hazard mitigation grant funding. You don't have a local hazard mitigation plan approved, you are not going to be eligible for that funding. So if anybody has any questions about that, you can reach out to me or my staff at any time, and we will be happy to assist. Or if you're already in the planning process with us and your plan's been submitted and you're waiting for approval or you're waiting for adjustments or feedback from the state or feedback from the feds, give us a call. We'll be happy to help you in any way that we possibly can to make sure that we get that done. Yes, sir.
Have you provided that information to our staff, or are we learning this for the first time?
Every single city that, so before we started this hazard mitigation planning project, we solicited every single city and every single special district in the county to participate with us.
So they're aware.
Everybody should be absolutely aware.
I just didn't trickle it down to the
This is a multi-year, it's a multi-year project. We've been doing this for a couple of years. But that being said, it's never too late. If any jurisdiction in the county of Riverside needs help, you can come to the county. We'll be happy to help you. And that's really where we're at. So we're going to keep that group. We put together a really good group that's working on that hazard mitigation planning. We're going to keep that group together because getting your plan approved is just the beginning of it. It's just the end of the beginning. Really, then we need to start looking at where are these projects and how can we cooperate? Because multi-jurisdictional projects get bumped to the front of the line for federal grant approvals. So the more that we can work on together as counties and local jurisdictions or local jurisdictions together, the more greater the likelihood that we're going to get some of these mitigation projects approved in the future.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. I appreciate the words, Mr. Abbey, as well. This is a collaborative effort. Like you said, this is something that we haven't seen in a lifetime, but something that's important from this is the debrief. What are we learning from this? How do we move forward? Oftentimes we plan for it, things that don't happen, and sometimes they get put in the back burner. Right now, we're not talking about earthquakes. God forbid we have one and we have to respond, right? So we always have to keep these things in the front of our spectrum. If staff can, if we can have this item continue on our next agenda for an update where we're at as far as our cities, our local cities, the hazard mitigation plan, because this is some vital information that we only get bits and pieces of it, but now to hear it, and we have it from the source where you can go out and put that out in the public. It's vital because there was a lot of damage out there. There's a lot of families who lost their homes and a lot of businesses who are suffering. So this is good information to have. We'll appreciate it. I know, Supervisor, you have some comments.
Just very quickly, thank you for the update, gentlemen. And you know, we've been thinking internally as to, and you hit the nail on the head, Mr. Chair, how do we move forward, lessons learned, things of that nature. And Dana, you know, although we've been working on these plans for years, not everyone is aware of this. And so, you know, we've been talking about how do we do this where we have this emergency response 101, if you will. It's one thing as policymakers for us to receive this information, but I think we have an easy job. It's the staff, really, that makes things move forward on a daily basis. And potentially, maybe something what we can do, Bruce and Jason and others, with our public safety partners, is obviously do the one-on-one on these plans, but then moving forward, ensuring how do we have constant communication, how do we coordinate, how do we collaborate with the nation. And so I like to see this on an ongoing basis, as mentioned by our chair, but really prepare staff to the level in which they feel they have the knowledge and potentially even the skill set to make things move for their own respective jurisdictions. I think that maybe that little piece of the puzzle might be missing. That's one piece that I wanted to bring up. The other is, you know, we heard about obviously Mission Creek, and you touched base on the Salton Sea and how eventually it ended up in the Salton Sea, a lot of debris and things of that nature. And you touched a bit on Cathedral City. You know, and then obviously within Cathedral City, you have Desert Hot Springs and Palm Springs. All these cities were impacted pretty badly. And so what I'm wondering is, was there any way possible for us to have been able to prevent any of this, knowing that, you know, the infrastructure potentially is maybe not in place or it's not up to par? As we're talking about our plans for the future, in other words, what can we do? So in case we do have some sort of crazy storm like the one we just had, in my understanding, we're going to have another one in the near future coming up within the next couple of weeks or so. I don't know how real that is. But what can we do to ensure that we're prepared? Now, our cities mobilized to the extent that they could at that time. But what can we do to make sure that they're ready to mobilize and have the expertise and working with everybody here in this circle to make sure that, you know, people are safe?
So I'll make a couple of comments and then I'll let Jason jump in, particularly on the infrastructure piece. I think the way that every city is prepared and how we work together, go back to your emergency operations plans. By state law, every city has to have an emergency operations plan, but an emergency operations plan, which basically is prescriptive on how you will function as a jurisdiction in an emergency and how you will interact with those around you, right? So a lot within your plan, there is the ability to cover a lot of the 101 level stuff. What are roles and responsibilities? What are the roles and responsibilities for electives? What are the roles and responsibilities for city staff? Who's going to do what? Have all of that prescripted out in your EOP, and then you got to drill on it. It can't just be, you know, one of those white binders that sits on the shelf somewhere. You got to turn it into a living document, right? We do in emergencies well what we do every day. If you have things and you have processes that are only sitting in an emergency plan that you expect to implement at the very worst time, at the very most stressful time, at the very most time critical time, right? It's not going to work out well. You have to find a way to integrate, and you know, this is the hat I wear, so I'm preaching from my pulpit, folks. You have to integrate a piece of emergency management into your day-to-day life. And so I think when the county made the commitment in putting EMD into place, I think that's the commitment that they made. So I would say to breathe life into your own program, you can start with your EOPs. And once again, we are now currently working on the county's emergency operations plan and have invited eight cities that want to go along with us and use our boilerplate to participate. Because, you know, at the end of the day, plans are great. You have to have them. You have to practice them. But depending on the size of the emergency like this one, unprecedented is, you know, we've heard unprecedented before, right? We've heard unprecedented during 2.5 years of COVID. We've heard unprecedented, you know, before with Valentine's Day storm in 2019, right? So unprecedented seems to be happening a lot. Mm-hmm. So the only way to prepare for unprecedented is to have those relationships, because any holes that you have in your plans, you fix them by the relationships that you have created and the people that you work with, knowing who to call, who has what resource, and knowing that you're going to be able to call and they're going to be responsive and they're going to work with you on a common goal. That's really it. So it's the relationship. So, I mean, that's the core of what this group does, right? So, I mean, I'm happy to come back at any point in time. As far as what can be done to prevent this, we talk a lot about community resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Growth without infrastructure that keeps up is not, you can't have community resilience. If that gap becomes too far, we can train people, fill sandbags, we can do all the CERT training in the world, we can have well-trained staff, we can take the protective measures that we take. But if growth and infrastructure don't keep up together, you can't have resilient communities. So it's right back to the infrastructure piece that Jason hit on, and I'll leave it with that.
Okay, thank you. And I'll touch on a couple things. It's, one, you know, that some of the canyons were getting hit with storms that were in excess of even our design standards for full-on infrastructure, right? You know, you look at Pearson Bridge and that big notch in the pier there, you know, like a 1,000-year storm came right through Pearson Bridge. And so you know, even in areas where we had infrastructure, in some locations it was being overwhelmed just because of the magnitude of the storm. The other thing that's very challenging is with as much sediment and materials moving around, you know, when we have events like this where there is sediment moving, the sediment can plug the primary path of water flow, and then the water tries to go a different direction. And you can't always predict exactly how that water is going to bounce around in these systems. And so was there more that could be done? Possibly, but I think all the agencies that were involved, like as Bruce said earlier, we put everything in that we could make sure we were ready as possible for the storm, and then whatever was going to happen was going to happen. You know, the challenges of what we can do better, I think Bruce is right. We need to make sure we're focusing on responsible growth, make sure we're focusing on, you know, paying attention to floodplains and keeping people out of hazard areas. You know, and then in the desert, you know, Indian Canyon Road, the Whitewater River is a mile and a half wide there, right? And so we've made this trade-off where we're going to have an at-grade crossing across the river. And so when that river flows, it's going to take out that road,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so there's trade-offs that are being made there that we're living with, knowing that these kinds of things can happen. You know, is eventually, is it going to be worth it to put a bridge there? Maybe. Is that bridge going to be incredibly expensive? Absolutely. You know, and I think that's why I think Palm Springs is focusing on maybe Vista Chino is maybe an early, no. you know, so it's the next best thing we can do is just working on this interim infrastructure to try to enhance it so that we can keep bounding in these areas of impact as best we can. But it's going to take time. It's going to take money.
It's to be honest, it's going to take state and federal support. The amount of infrastructure we need in the valley is more than all of us together have resources for. And so it's going to be that collective effort of working together, working with Bruce's team, working with FEMA to get the money to the region so that we can be better prepared for the next event.
Well, appreciate that. You know, I just want to touch on something Bruce said about relationships, and I want to recognize Coachella Valley Economic Partnerships for coming through the sandbags. I don't know how they put those sandbags out of the air, but we were able to get them out to the communities, and that was a good message to get that night that we were going to have some sandbags because they really helped us out in some of those areas. Also, we talked about infrastructure. You know, folks are saying, well, you need to build Indian. We need to build a 44 low crossing Indian. Well, you know what? Working with Mr. Kirk here and our transportation teams, our Riverside County Transportation Commission, which we all sit on, those are already in the works. But a lot of it is funding, like you mentioned. So we need to be aggressive when we're dealing with Washington, D.C., and we're dealing with Sacramento, getting the fundings. Because right after this storm passed, the president had a press conference, but he mentioned Maui. And he mentioned Florida because they just had a hurricane. Mm-hmm. No mention them in California. So we need to be assertive, you know, but nice, but assertive. And when our reps are up there, whether it's county supervisor, whether it's congressperson or senator, we need to be behind them or beside them asking for those funds because we've been planning these infrastructure projects for a long time. And it does, they're very expensive. But in interest of time, I want to move on. We want to continue the subject.
Can we just touch on one thing? I'm not going to rehash anything, but I do want to also mention that the work and the importance of what the non-governmental organizations have done and are continuing to do. And I'm anticipating this would, of course, be part of the plan, in particular as it comes to aftermath. But, you know, we had a lot come forward. The Team Rubicon, you know, we're talking about what government can do and what they can't do. Team Rubicon particularly came and is still working. I think they may be finishing up now, moving on to other disasters. But they're a great example. World Kitchen, of course, the Red Cross that we always see, but even some ones that we wouldn't necessarily anticipate, like Visit Greater Palm Springs, was a great, that I guess that might qualify as a governmental entity, but Home Depot, Vertec, if you saw the role that Vertec has taken in this, there's really too many to mention. That's just the only thing that I wanted to make sure that we recognize the importance of our non-governmental partners, our business partners, and other community groups that really, you know, it's not better. It's still a great disaster. What happened in Cathedral City, especially the mud flow part of it. We had flooding parts of it, which were anticipated, but the mud flow is just can't be understated. So after our great public safety fire we're able to make the initial rescues, of course, the disaster continues. The disaster continues today and will for many, many months. But I just want to mention also those parts that the non-government rights
are very important. So we appreciate that. So we'll continue this. Just a quick comment, and we have several questions. I'm glad this is going to come back because we'll be able to answer some of those or ask some of those questions. But as it came up today, and I saw on the slide, several of our committees that are affected, and it might be a good idea that maybe the chair of all of our committees be on opening basis or maybe twice a year. So we're kind of all on the same page moving forward. I don't think that's something we've done before, but maybe it's something that we can do. So everybody's on the same page as it relates to CBAG. And that, you know, because all of our communities are intertwined in those areas. So it might be something that we might be able to take a look at.
Absolutely. Just for the purposes of time, and I know there's a lot of great ideas. Sorry about that. Maybe if staff is willing to take this information back and then in November bring back recommendations for us to consider, like the one you just mentioned right now, John and others, just to kind of move this ball forward as well. Just also, we don't have that much more time when staff get into asylum seekers and we still have to vote in our committee members.
Yeah, we'll appreciate that, and we'll keep that discussion going. What I'm going to do is I'm going to jump around, if I may, on the agenda, because we do have some items. Speaking of collaboration, we need to get this Mylar balloon item, because that's going to go to our energy committee. So I'm going to skip over the assignment seekers, and the time permits, we'll go back. If not, we'll continue to the next meeting. So I want to move to item C, which is Mylar balloons in the public. And this has been in discussion for a while, but we want to provide some direction. And I know the city of Palm Desert has moved forward with this. So what I will do, I'll pass to say, Erica, if you want to take this out, we'll go ahead and go to the council member.
Yes, I'm going to do some brief introductory remarks, and I'll be brief because this is an item you all have talked about quite a bit. I call Mylar balloons festive, but they are made out of non-biodegradable material, which causes a number of environmental challenges. And this item came to you a couple times last year from our partners over at IID and Edison because of the concerns with the electric lines. This video demonstrates it better than I could. In the Coachella Valley, we have had quite a number of Mylar balloon-related power outages, and IID provided some data when they came last year, and this is customers impacted by Mylar balloon-related incidents, meaning they lost their power because of a Mylar balloon-related power outage. This information is a little dated, but you can see from the numbers, it's thousands. And since the 1990s, the state has done some regulations. Last year, there was a few debates at this committee level about whether a model ordinance should be considered at, for the Coachella Valley, that would be on the sale and possession. And at the time, you all decided instead to support state legislation that would slowly fade out the use of Mylar balloons. This item is coming back to you at the request of the city of Palm Desert, which has okayed a ban Mylars in both parks and city recreation areas. The ban went into effect on August 20th. It's probably a little early to tell how effective it is going to be. They're doing a number of educational related outreach, and they're seeking some regional endorsement. This item will also be going to your colleagues over the Energy and Sustainability Committee, which meets on Thursday. It's staff recommendation to either provide a direction on pursuing a model ordinance. Another option could be to, if you all supported the Palm Desert approach, you could make that known in the vote of endorsement, and then we could circulate it to our member states for their own consideration. Mayor Pro Tem Quintanilla.
Thank you very much, Erica. I'll keep it super brief. Discussions here were taken back to your council, which then distributed to our public safety and our vision of sustainability. Sustainability said ban it altogether. Parks and Rec had their own discussions. So at the council level, we agreed that the first step would be to include our language regarding park permits to say no Mylar. And from there, a gradual phase in. The discussion was about having an outright ban on the sale, but we acknowledge that you can buy in one city and still use yours. So this is the first step to have the language stating that we will not accept them in our public spaces. And from there, we can continue. Am I missing anything from staff? Okay, super brief because I know we've got tons to get through, so we would appreciate your support. Thanks.
Yes. With that being said, I think now we want to provide direction from this committee because this is going to our energy committee later this week. Yes, sir.
Start that off. So initially, you would think coming from law enforcement, I'd love having laws, but I also understand sometimes you don't want to have laws that seem to placate because they look like they're addressing something, but they don't really address it. So I was a fan of really pushing the state to try to do something because I think the actual solution to this is to actually come up with either an alternative or a ban statewide. So I know they've moved, but they're moving. They watered it down, as tends to happen, because you have a lot of interest in the state consideration. So the second part of that is I didn't necessarily see punishing the business community as a good first step for this because of what was already shared that, you know, you could punish your own local retailers and then you're going to have them just going to the next city and buying in the next city or county or even coming from Los Angeles or Orange County.
That online. Type
of thing. Online, all types of things. So, but with that said, I do see and appreciate that the banning the use in the parks and public spaces is a good tool. It's easier and more practical to address, I would say. And it also is great as an education piece into Mylar balloons because when you do find that they're in there, besides telling them, you know, taking them away or what, however they, that it, it's enforced, there's also the education piece as to why they're problematic. So I think that that is a good approach to take. Thank you.
If I can add one final piece regarding education, after the meeting in which we discussed this, somebody made the comment that hospitals are also seeing a shortage of helium. So this would be another way to contribute. There is an additional health component.
Well, just as part of recommendation, those are good comments. And if I would take a motion to adopt Palm Desert's the ordinance, send that up to our energy committee from this committee.
I motion.
I'll second.
So I have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Captain Gibb and second by.
And a quick comment too is that I think that we also send this to our school districts because graduations, it's being taken to graduation ceremonies and things like that too. So hopefully we can get them on board as well.
Yeah, staff, we can work with the school district as well. It's a great idea. I mean, that's going to be part of the educational components, so that's a great idea. So I do have motion on the floor and a second. Can I take a roll call vote? Thanks. I'm sorry. I want to do a roll call vote so bad. Can I have one? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Des Ross, please. Yes. All right. Any nays? No abstentions? Okay. Motion passes. So thank you, Palm Desert, for that. So we'll move on to the next item, which would be election of the Public Safety Committee officers. And we would have Mr. Kirk.
They were wondering if I was actually going to work today. This is it. Every year you do this in your CVAC committees. Your chair this year, of course, is Councilmember Furman from the city of Indio. And your vice chair is Councilmember Gregory from the city of Cathedral City. What's the pleasure of the committee? Are there any nominations for chair and or vice chair?
Does Councilmember Furman want to continue to be the chair? Are you willing?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I would nominate Councilmember Furman to remain as the chair.
Is there a second to that nomination?
Second.
Are there any other nominations for chair? Hearing none, all in favor, please say
aye. Aye.
There you go. Chair, you want to take the election for vice chair?
Double.
Any nominations for vice chair?
I'll nominate Raymond Craig.
I'll second that.
Any other nominations? Hearing none, all in favor, please say
aye.
Aye. And City of Desert Island.
Aye.
This is a privilege and honor to serve this committee. Public safety is my passion since I was a kid. Sergeant Corden can attest to that. And so, and thank you, Mr. Gregory, for being the vice chair. And we'll continue to move forward. This job is never over. Sometimes public safety gets pushed to the side, but as we can see from this meeting today, very important stuff. So thank you, and we'll move on. So we do have one item, but I don't know if Bruce, if you could go through that item briefly. The
Title 40Q?
Yes. We do have, it's 10 o'clock, but we get maybe a couple minutes.
Okay. If you go to that first slide, I'll try to make this quick.
I think this is important. I don't want this to continue to November.
Okay. You can just do this. That's right there. So, immigration surge update. You can go to the next slide. The operation is ongoing. We received to date 85,469 migrants that have applied for asylum. Title 42 has been lifted. However, the Biden administration did implement new rules, including if you get caught trying to cross, you can't apply for asylum. Federal court has struck down those rules, but given the administration 60-day stay. So long story short, what those actual rules are going to end up looking like are actually still going to be adjudicated between the administration and the court system. However, the bottom line is our average daily volume has nosedived after the lifting of Title 42. We were seeing regularly 300 a day. We're now getting 30 to 70 per day. And as well as some NGO to NGO. So the non-government organizations are going to be taking over the operations.
Is we Riverside County, what is we when we receive? The whole county or just the Coachella Valley?
So we receive them through Blythe, through
EDO. So you said we get like 30 a day. Who is we? Is it the county?
It's the county.
Thank you.
It's the entire county.
Thank you.
Right now they're coming mostly through Murrieta. They're coming up from San Diego into the Murrieta Border Patrol Station. One of the reasons the county is in the situation is it started off with they're going to push all of the asylum seekers out to all of their border patrol stations. We're the only non-border county that has border patrol stations, Blythe, Indio, Murrieta. So that's why we ended up being in, I would call, the business, but really supporting this humanitarian mission, as well as trying to mitigate the impacts on our communities. Because had we not initiated the response that we did as a county, these would have been street releases at those locations and at transportation hubs around those locations. So we set up this operation to receive them from Border Patrol. The communication with them still remains excellent. But like I said, it's dropped way off. The state had put together an incident management team in San Diego that was helping to manage the entire flow of both migrants coming legally across the border as well as what we call EWs. They enter without inspection. Those are the folks that come across illegally, and those are most of the folks that we have been getting here in Riverside County. They set up an incident management team in San Diego, so it was very much a government-run operation all the way around. And the state is now standing down that incident management team. It's mostly Catholic charities, NGO. If you look at pre-COVID, they were the ones that were really taking in all of these folks that were migrating. And so we're going back to that model, and we as government entities, both at the state level and at the local county level, will be supporting those NGOs to take that mission on. It's really more of their core mission. All of the pieces that we had to put in place during COVID as far as the health screenings and the testing and the vaccinations and all of that, that has all ceased across the board. So along with the lower numbers, it allows us to, in a very organized way, in a planned way, with those non-government organizations, for them to be able to take this over and provide that humanitarian aid, as well as provide a place for them to be, so we don't have impacts on our communities of people that have been released on the street. That's really it. We will have a contingency in place that if we do have another surge, we can step in and support those NGOs. Funding is in place through the end of the year, and discussions on ongoing funding that will mostly pass from the county to the non-government organizations to support them. That's really going to be the plan going forward. So any questions I can answer?
Well, appreciate that update. If we can we get your slides sent to the committee? Because
sure.
A lot of information, the good information, we want to make sure it's accurate. We appreciate that. And so we'll move on to the next item, which is an informational item. It's all in your agenda packet. And so item number 10 is public comments for non-agenda items. Do we have any public comment? Okay, our next item of announcement. So our next public safety committee meeting is Monday, November 13th at 9 a.m. here in this room. And the next executive meeting is Monday, September 25th. And we will adjourn this meeting in the memory of CAL FIRE Assistant Chief Josh Bishop, Fire Captain Kevin Rodriguez, and Pilot Tony Sosa. Meeting is adjourned.